My pleasure to present the results of a trial that we conducted over the last 5 years and also talk about its implication. The title of the study, which is a mouthful, is HIV Prevention Trials Network 039, which is a phase 3 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial of acyclovir for the reduction of HIV acquisition. So in the next 30 minutes, I will try to summarize very briefly the data that led to the rationale for this trial, as well as new findings in HSV pathogenesis with respect to frequency of reactivation and immune response in the genital tract, as well as the design of our trial and a similar trial in Mwanza, Tanzania. And we'll then talk about other studies that are still ongoing looking at herpes suppression to prevent HIV transmission, and then end on clinical and public health implications. Simple slide that captures or tries to capture 20 years worth of data that started in the 80s, really, in which there was indication that herpes simplex virus type 2 infection increased both susceptibility to HIV and then later data suggesting it might increase infectiousness. There are also data from fewer studies, but still consistently showing that HIV increases the frequency of HSV2 outbreaks and may facilitate HSV2 transmission. So these two viruses interact with each other, and we think the synergy is important in terms of fueling the HIV epidemic. So in one slide, without boring you with all the individual studies, I'll just summarize that at the time that Esther Freeman did a systematic review in 2006, there were 18 longitudinal studies in which you could demonstrate that HSV2 predated when people became HIV infected, and in which they collected both age and sexual behavior data and adjusted for those. And the summary of those studies indicates that for heterosexual men and women, there's about a threefold increased risk of becoming HIV infected if you're HSV2 seropositive, regardless of recognized symptoms of herpes, and a little lower, about 1.7, for men who have sex with men. If you plug that into the formula for population attributable fraction, you get that depending on the HSV2 prevalence in the population, anywhere from 38% to 69% of new HIV infections in women are attributed to herpes, and 8% to 49% in men. Why would that be? So you always, epidata are suggestive, but you also need biologic plausibility. And there's several lines of evidence. First, clinically, we know that herpes causes macroscopic, visible, shallow ulcerations. We know that even apart from clinical reactivations, herpes causes reactivation is frequent. And recent data from Seattle suggests that it's on the order of 20% of days that herpes PCR is positive and HIV negative men and women, and that these reactivations are often short, 12 hours average duration, but reasonable titer or copy number, 10 to the third. So this notion that herpes is a latent virus is actually probably somewhat of a misconception, that it's actually on quite a bit. Recent data from Nairobi also lead into the immunologic mechanism, in that when they studied HSV2 positive women and among the HIV negative women, none were shedding herpes virus at the time they did this cross-sectional sampling. There was an increase in cervical CD4 positive T cells, CCR5 positive cells, as well as immature dendritic cells. So it appears that we have a recruitment of target cells to the genital mucosa in HSV2 positive persons. So for those who are not clinicians or not familiar with the drugs, I just want to highlight that we have tools to try to interrupt the synergy. And the tool is our antivirals against herpes, either acyclovir, valacyclovir, or famciclovir. And all three of these drugs target a specific enzyme only present in herpes viruses, thymidine kinase. From clinical studies, we know that these drugs are effective in shortening the duration of genital ulcers in episodic treatment. And we know when taken twice daily or once daily in the case of valacyclovir, you can also reduce shedding on the order of 80% to 90%. just to highlight that these drugs have no activity against HIV, so if we observe an effect, it's herpes specific. They're very safe and well tolerated, and resistance is very rare. So using that concept that we have an effective tool against herpes, two studies were designed to ask the question of, if you suppressed herpes, could you reduce the risk of HIV acquisition as much as 50-fold? And the first study, which was completed last about 7 months ago by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, was conducted in Mwanza, Tanzania. And the results will be published this week in the New England Journal. And then we had a trial among men who have sex with men in the US and Peru, as well as women in Zambia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. So I'll tell you the highlights of both these studies. The Mwanza trial used acyclovir 400 twice daily versus matching placebo. They recruited women who were, in some cases, informal sex workers. Other cases, they were bar workers. And they were in areas around the gold mines in Mwanza, Tanzania. They were followed for 12 to 30 months. They had mobile clinics and were seen quarterly. And in the same cohort, they looked both at HIV positive and HIV negative women to look at shedding and acquisition of HIV, respectively. The issue with the Mwanza trial is that because they were seen quarterly and it was a fairly mobile population, that adherence was that about 73% of the women took at least 75% of the study drug. And on this slide, on the bottom row, you'll see that there is basically no difference in HIV acquisition rates between the acyclovir and placebo arms. So it was a null result, and the question was it adherence? Do you need higher adherence to get sufficient herpes suppression to achieve an HIV effect? And it highlighted, I think, the challenges that many of these HIV prevention trials are facing in terms of the need for high adherence and low loss to follow-up. And it's feasible, but it's definitely resource-dependent. And I think it also highlighted, as a number of other HIV prevention trials in the last year, is that we really need to focus more on what the barriers and motivators to adherence are in these trials. And since it was a small trial with 55 endpoints, which isn't sufficient in terms of power to really do subgroup analyses, it also highlighted the need for an important question like this to have more than one trial. So our trial, which was funded by the US NIH, was conducted among two risk groups, women from Harare, Lusaka, and Johannesburg, and gay men from Lima, Iquitos, Pucallpa, Peru, as well as Seattle, San Francisco, and New York, in which HIV-negative, HSV2-positive persons were randomized, again, to the same dose, acyclovir 400 twice a day or matching placebo, and both arms were eligible for episodic acyclovir for genital ulcers during the trial and received very intensive risk reduction counseling. We saw our participants monthly as opposed to quarterly in the Mwanza trial, in which during those visits we measured drug adherence by both pill count and self-report, had intensive counseling about adherence, dispensed another month's worth of study drug, asked about genital ulcers, STD symptoms, and sexual behavior, and if they had symptoms, a genital exam was done and syndromic treatment provided, and everyone received free condoms and safe sex counseling. Quarterly, all participants had a blood draw for HIV antibodies, a genital exam, and if lesions were consistent with herpes, swabs for herpes PCR were obtained. And again, episodic acyclovir was offered if they had an active recurrence. To be conservative, since there was very little experience with acyclovir in pregnancy in Africa, both the Mwanza and the HPTN039 trial stopped study drug until the pregnancy test was negative. These trials are a huge effort. Almost 12,000 persons were screened for HPTN039, 3,277 were enrolled, about 105 were excluded from the analysis because they were either HIV seroconverting at enrollment, a handful tried to enroll more than once, and about 70 had a negative herpes Western blot. So that left us with, for our primary analysis, 3,172 participants, of which almost 40% were enrolled from Peru and another 40% from Africa. Notably, the retention was high given the duration of 18-month follow-up at 85% and equal in both arms. So in this busy table, I'm trying to show you the diversity of our population. And you'll see that the gay men who were recruited from the U.S. sites were significantly older than the Peruvian gay men. There was a lower education among the African women and the Peruvian MSM, higher number of partners, particularly among the men from Peru, higher number of sex acts among the women, and at enrollment, 90% of the women reported at least some unprotected vaginal sex in the last 3 months, where it was closer to about 50% of the Peruvian gay men and a third of the U.S. gay men had unprotected receptive anal sex. And then for insertive anal, unprotected anal sex, it was 21 and 40% respectively. Most, as in prior studies, most of the participants did not know they had herpes based on questions we asked at an enrollment. So overall, it was about 80% had unrecognized herpes at the time they were screened and enrolled in the study. A higher proportion of women than men had lesions on exam that were called herpes, but I just want to make the footnote that we know the 20% is high. It included some non-specific findings that are probably not herpes that were recorded like cervicitis as possible herpes in the women's sites. Most other STIs were infrequent. There was a high baseline syphilis seropositivity in Peru, but it was very low titer and consistent with past treatment or late latent. Very little gonorrhea, less than 1% across all the sites, 6% chlamydia, 8% trichomoniasis. 14% of the women became pregnant during the study, which is high but low compared to some of the microbicide trials. And very different rates of male circumcision, 82% among the U.S. men and 6% among the Peruvians. This was our slide that took time to come to terms with, which was basically overlapping curves throughout the study and no difference in HIV acquisition with a p-value of 0.39. So was adherence a factor in our trial? Primarily based on pill count and in a small percentage of visits where we didn't have pills return, self-report, at all visits and with comparable rates between the placebo and acyclovir arm, we had 94% of pills dispensed taken. And very few, less than 4% of visits, did people report consecutive missed doses, which we think is necessary before you'll see herpes reactivation. Excuse me. This is showing you the relative risk of HIV based on average adherence during the trial, and it shows that even among those with overall 90% or higher adherence, the relative risk of HIV was 1. Showing you some data by pre-specified subgroups, although there are differences with apparent higher risk of HIV among the African women compared to the MSM, none of these subgroups of risk group, adherence, or GUD enrollment were statistically significant. This slide shows you the data in terms of the relative risk of incident genital ulcers in the acyclovir compared with the placebo arm. And on the left-hand series of histograms, you'll see that including overall genital ulcers, there was a 37% reduction. However, if you limit it to those that were HSV PCR positive, it was a 64% reduction. And there were significant reductions, with the men in the U.S. achieving almost an 88% reduction in herpes-specific ulcers. Excuse me, about a 62% reduction in men in Peru and about a 60% reduction in women from Africa. So statistically significant differences by region. Among the almost 2,000 swabs that were sent to Seattle for HSV DNA PCR, a little over half of the swabs from placebo participants were PCR positive for herpes, and about a third of the acyclovir swabs. So highly statistically significant, but less of a reduction in herpes PCR on the acyclovir arm than we had anticipated. And in this slide, I'm showing you the same data, but now showing by histogram the quantity of herpes in those that had detectable herpes by PCR. And basically, the mean and the median is almost identical for the placebo and acyclovir recipients from Africa and Peru, and it's only in the middle panel from the U.S. MSM where you see a shift to the left and a reduction in amount of herpes in the acyclovir arm. So our conclusions were that in this trial that acyclovir 400 twice daily did not reduce the risk of HIV acquisition among high-risk HIV-negative HSV2 seropositive gay men and women in the context of a trial where adherence to study drug was high. The drug was safe and well tolerated. This is the largest trial ever of herpes suppression, and I think we'll learn a lot about the natural history of herpes in diverse populations. We did see that suppressive acyclovir did reduce the incidence of genital ulcers, particularly among those that were proven to be due to herpes. And we observed a high prevalence and some non-specificity and site variability in GUD diagnoses among women. So our trial was consistent with the Mwanza Tanzania trial that showed no reduction in HIV acquisition among high-risk women treated with acyclovir 400 twice daily. This was surprising and very disappointing, yet a very important result for HIV prevention. So the question we're left with and we're trying to tease out is whether the lack of efficacy is related to the concept or to the intervention. And there are really three broad categories of how you might interpret these results. The first is that herpes is not a risk factor for HIV. It's a risk marker, and that biologically it's not really increasing the susceptibility to HIV. That's possible, but personally I would say I think it's unlikely that herpes is just confounding the epi data, because the data are so consistent from different populations in different regions of the world. Secondly, it appears that herpes in this trial and in the Mwanza trial responded less well to acyclovir compared to past studies done in the US, Australia, and Europe. So that leads us to the possibilities that perhaps the drug was less well absorbed, or perhaps there is resistance. Again, I don't think those are likely to be the explanation, but we'll look at that. It's possible that because there's such strong incentive for people to be in the study and social desirability plays a factor, that perhaps adherence is overestimated by pill count and self-report, and people figured how to manipulate the pill counts to match what we expected. Third possibility is that there's a different natural history of genital ulcers due to herpes in African women, and again, there are no data to really directly address that, but it's an important issue to sort out. And then lastly, perhaps there are other etiologies of ulcers that are important. Going back to the PCR slide, where only 55% of swabs in the placebo arm were HSV PCR positive. So I think those are all possible questions that we'll try to investigate. But I think the third possibility, which is almost the opposite of the first, is that it's not that herpes isn't important, but that we've underestimated it in terms of the frequency of reactivation and the genital immune response. And to effectively deal with it, we need better virologic and or immunologic tools. I'm going to anticipate a question that I've been asked many times since the study results became available, which is, would we have had a different result had we used a different dose or a drug with a little longer half-life like valacyclovir? And I think we can only extrapolate from the data that are available, but if you go back to a paper by Mike Rutano in the late 90s, there's no difference in effect on genital ulcer incidence among immunocompetent persons who had less than 10 recurrences per year if you looked at val acyclovir a gram a day versus acyclovir 400 BID. If you haven't seen it and you're interested in this topic, I would encourage you to read a kind of basic science-y paper that came out last year from the Seattle group that suggests that perhaps part of the explanation here is that there's a much more robust and persistent immune response in the genital tract among people who are herpes positive. And on the top panel, the green cells are CD8 positive herpes cells that infiltrate at the site of a lesion And then in the bottom slide, there's an example of showing those cells clustering around the green sensory peripheral nerves, and they can persist for weeks, perhaps even months, after herpes reactivation. So there's a lot more to be learned, particularly about the CD4 response in genital herpes, but it's possible that this is what's mediating the lack of efficacy in our trial. So just to wrap up, I think that I want to highlight that this is not the end of the story, that we believe that there are different interactions between herpes and HIV and someone who's already HIV infected, and that the studies that are testing these concepts will be done in the next year to 2 years, so we'll know whether or not you can reduce HIV infectiousness and transmission by suppressing herpes. We'll be following the seroconverters in HPT-039 and seeing whether or not you can lower the set point of HIV by herpes suppression at the time they're infected with HIV. And then, very importantly, from a clinical perspective, is can we slow HIV disease progression by suppressing herpes with our trial partners in prevention as well as a trial in RAKAI. Meanwhile, I think the basic scientists are going to be doing a lot more to try to tease out the biology in both HIV negative and HIV positive persons to understand the genital immune activation and persistence, as well as the clinical significance of these short bursts of herpes shedding. Meanwhile, we believe we need new drugs with new targets and longer duration of activity, and desperately need a herpes vaccine. So what are these implications for HIV, implications of these two trials for herpes with respect to HIV prevention? First of all, I think with two negative trials now, it's clear that we do not provide suppressive acyclovir to HIV negative persons for the specific purpose of HIV prevention. By this time next year, we should have the data from partners in prevention to know whether or not there are benefits either from a public health or clinical perspective of herpes suppression to reduce HIV transmission and disease progression. I want to remind you that on its own merits, there's value to using herpes suppression for clinical benefits for people who are infected, as well as to prevent HSV transmission. I think we are not using a reasonably good tool that we have, which is serologic testing, and that helps people with respect to behavior change, symptom recognition, and to reduce herpes suppression. And I think that we need to scale up testing and need to do a whole lot more than we are in terms of provider and patient education about genital herpes, and to use an expression that was popularized about 10 years ago in HIV, we need to stop our denial and nihilism and break the silence about herpes, because I think we need to not just take these two results and say from these trials that we don't need to deal with herpes. I think actually the opposite is true. So lastly, let me just end that I think that this, again, to remind you that the story's not over, that this synergy between these two viruses is important, I believe. It's relevant to both men and women. The seroprevalence rates are extremely high, particularly among HIV-positive persons. We do have tools. We have a generic safe drug, acyclovir, that's available. It's on the essential drug list in developing countries. Valacyclovir will be off patent in a year. And we hope that we'll have a tool to reduce HIV transmission and infectiousness. But if we find that tool, we're going to have to be prepared to use it, because no tool is going to have an impact unless we actually deliver it. So I think the last slide is just lessons I've learned on a personal note, that this is a hard area. HIV prevention is much more challenging than I would have predicted 20 years ago when I started down this path. These clinical trials are harder than you think. That we need to not get too discouraged. Negative trials, even when they do make a contribution, particularly if they're done well. The most important questions are also often the hardest, that we need to stay focused, grow from the challenges, work with people we respect and enjoy, and don't give up. And I just want to acknowledge the many people who contributed to HPT-039, particularly Anna Wald, Larry Corey, Jim Hughes, and the site PIs from Peru, Africa, the US, the team at FHI, SHARP, Central Labs, our DSMB, IRBs, CABs, Division of AIDS, and the study participants. This was a huge effort, done well, and I think all those people, including the study participants, really deserve a real vote of appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you, Connie. The main discussion is going to be withheld until we have a panel discussion after all three speakers. But we have time for one or two very focused questions, specifically technical issues about Connie's presentation and the data as opposed to the broad conceptual issues, please.
Hi, Mayor.
Dr.
Camp. Connie,
thanks. That was a really nice presentation. We don't think about condoms as being so effective in herpes, but I think the cohort studies have been pretty consistent in showing that even for herpes, condoms can show some effect. And I'm wondering if you guys have had a chance to look to see how much condom use was going on in your population, after they were enrolled and educated and counseled and so forth.
So in case you couldn't hear, Mary's asking about condom use and how it increased during this follow-up. We're still looking at the longitudinal data, but for both men who have sex with men and women, the condom use really increased dramatically, and it was comparable in both arms of the study, so it did go up. But I just want to point out that what's, I think, also sobering here is that this is a study where people were seen monthly and received free condoms, STI treatment, and we still had, I don't think I showed you that slide, but the overall HIV incidence was 3.6, and it was 4% among women. So one out of 25 women became infected with an average of one partner, with monthly visits and condom use. So it's not enough, obviously.
Okay, we'll take these two questions, brief questions and brief responses here first, and then the center microphone.
I have a clarifying question about suppression. So when we say suppression, are we speaking solely about, you know, the number of outbreaks or shedding in general as a whole? What does suppression actually mean? And I'm wondering how that plays into, you know, are these drugs really what we want? Do we want something different that may be able to do what we are trying to do?
Yeah. So when we talk about suppression, we're talking about both reducing clinical apparent recognized lesions as well as subclinical herpes reactivation. We did not do a shedding sub-study, so I can't tell you how much shedding was reduced in this study, but past studies, that was one of the first slides I showed, show that you, with this dose of drug, if it's absorbed the same way and people are adherent, should reduce shedding by about 80 to 90%, and also genital ulcers in the same ballpark.
Lynn Barkley.
Thank you. Connie, you mentioned break the silence, and I represent the American Social Health
Association.
Go closer to the mic.
Okay. You mentioned break the silence. Can you hear me now? You mentioned break the silence.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Yeah, I'm feeling deaf right now. So,
I'm a mother. My voice carries. What can organizations like the American Social Health Association, the CDC, what should we be doing to increase HSV discussion, HSV activity testing, screening? What do you recommend we do?
Well, I don't want to steal the thunder of Peter or Susan, but I think that's what the next two talks are about. Personally, listening to the discussion with the case studies today, I think there's a whole lot more than we can be doing, and many people coming to STD clinics assume that they're being tested for herpes amongst everything else. And I think it was in a Philadelphia meeting of this group four years ago that Larry Corey proposed somewhat radically that we should be getting signed consent, that people understand that they're not being tested for herpes, because I think it's really something that we have not done a good job of in STD programs, and probably has a higher yield, higher prevalence, and potentially more impact for the people coming to STD clinics.